This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A two-day summit, as the organizers called it, on public transportation began last week with some discussions about the economic growth potential that connectivity can have and spur, and about the responsibilities as well that go along with it. The Gary Public Transportation Corporation hosted the conference, which brought a number of public officials as well as planners, administrators, and advocacy groups together. They're trying to prompt some regional discussions on the social and economic aspects of public transportation. Two of them are GPTC General Manager Daryl Lampkins and Dave Wellman, representing the Northwest Indiana RDA. They were with us on Regionally Speaking. Daryl starts out with how public transportation is right now and how it can be improved.
I think that what we are lacking here in Northwest Indiana is what most transit agencies today are facing, and that's resources. Mm-hmm. The larger communities that you're in, they have access to larger resources, but what they also have is traffic congestion, and traffic congestion tends to lead to push people more to transit. When you have an option one way or the other. We don't have a lot of traffic congestion in Northwest Indiana, but that doesn't minimize the need for choice and needed dependent riders. I came in about 12 years ago, Gary Public Transportation, and we have not grown very much. We like to call it that we've remained steady. And what we're attempting to do is just start the conversation in terms of how do we expand transit in all modes. The Westlake Quarter is one thing that's on the radar. I think that bus dovetails well into that. Mm-hmm. You need bus if you're going to expand rail for connectivity, but you also have airport traffic and bike traffic, and we want to just start the conversation. How do we tie all of those things together?
GPTC has been really working hard to try to take over in a way, because we at one point had several public transportation systems that were working at the same time here in particular in Lake County, and then down to basically only one. It ended up being down to Gary's, and I know that meant a lot of work for you folks to be able to take on routes that were out there in other communities. Tell us what you all faced here when you found that the number of players, the number of public transit companies in the region suddenly came down to one.
Well, I hesitate to use the word take over. We prefer to use the term that we filled a void, mm-hmm. and where transit went away. And it was the situation, again, it was regarding funding. The agencies that couldn't that are no longer with us ran out of funds. There are a few other agencies that do exist that provide some paratransit transportation. We are the only fixed route provider. Well, I take that back. East Chicago has a system also. So there's two fixed route services that are remaining in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm.
That might be something important to talk about is to how the funding is set up so that in particular that GPTC is able to operate here. And because that's the same kind of funding that these other agencies had trouble obtaining, it's something to talk about because we're talking, what, state and federal as well as local, aren't we?
Absolutely. We do receive funding from the federal government. We receive funding from the state government. And our local funding is primarily due through property taxes and fare box and any other type of fundings that we can find. Multiple sources, advertising, for instance, is one that we do when you see maybe some of the buses wrapped and things like that. So the challenge that we have with the funding is on the local end primarily, mm-hmm. In terms of securing an increase or stable funding to match the federal dollars that we use.
Now, Dave Wellman, who is here with the Northwest Indiana RDA, is one of the partners in trying to see some improvement in all of this. And we know that RDA plays a very big role in all of this. What does the RDA have to do when it comes to public transportation?
Well, currently the primary project that we're backing is the recapitalization of the South Shore Line,
right,
which includes the Westlake Corridor and as well as double tracking the existing South Shore Line. We have spent the last roughly 3 years putting together a package of local and state support in terms of funding to get to about half the cost of that of doing those two projects, and are now in the process of applying to the federal government for grants to cover the other 50% of the cost. So again, we're in a similar boat as Daryl is, in that resources are the primary limiting factor at the moment, and we're working as hard as we can to overcome that.
Now, obviously, in the case of the RDA, you're working very closely with all of the communities here in the region, including the community of Gary. And I know in your case, Daryl, that you have to basically go to the Common Council and to Mayor Freeman Wilson and ask for help if you need it in particular, even though that you are able to pick up other communities as far as your service area is concerned. Do you find that that this is sort of a common problem, that in this case here, the RDA is working to look for a commitment to be able to show some support for, in this case, for the expansion on the South Shore line, as well as you're looking for assistance as well, I suppose, maybe more beyond local, for expanding the public transit for service?
Absolutely. We've partnered with the RDA over the years, and they've been a supporter of some service that we had for the Lakeshore Connection and the old Tri-City route. We understand as an agency also that not just the RDA, but some of the other municipalities, that we're all competing for a limited amount of funds. And what we're attempting to do at this summit is to not only display, but to also convince and to bring in some stakeholders and discuss some of the challenges and how we can move towards future growth in the region, talk about efficiencies and effectiveness. One thing that we have done at Gary Public Transportation over the last 12 years or so is we've just improved our operation to the point where right now we just can't go any further without other communities and agencies buying in. And that's what we're looking to start that conversation.
GPTC General Manager Daryl Lampkins, joined by Dave Wellman, representing the Northwest Indiana RDA. Last week's Transportation Summit ended with comments from Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson and Department of Transportation Acting Regional Administrator Kelly Brookins. The 19th Annual Walk for Sojourner Truth House is coming up on Saturday morning, June 9th. And to find out more about it, let's check in with Sharita Brewer, who for the last few years has been doing a lot of work on this annual walk. Sharita, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with what Sojourner Truth House is all about, tell us about the house and the benefits that they give to Northwest Indiana residents.
Sojourner Truth House was founded in 1997 by Sisters from the Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ, which is an order in Donaldson, who wanted to give back to the community by helping women. The primary focus of Sojourner Truth House is delivered through three streams of service. Mm-hmm. They serve homeless women and children who are housed at four local shelters by providing them with basic education training, with skills learning, financial literacy, assistance when they need some counseling for substance abuse issues or mental health issues. They give them access to services in the community so that they can then get the help that they need with those specialized things and other things. And with the ultimate goal of bringing them to a point where they're able to be more self-sustainable and getting them into permanent and safe housing. Mm-hmm. And then the second stream of service is the program called TOPS, which is Transitional Outreach Program Participants. And those are clients who have been housed, who were formerly homeless, who are now in their own housing, but who may still benefit from recovery treatment programs or literacy programs. They may be in the middle of applying for benefits and things like that that might take them longer than just to get into housing. Third stream, which is actually the largest number, is those in the community who have intermittent emergency needs. And they are folks who are the working poor or those who've been affected by the economy and perhaps not able to find work. And they are able to come once a month for food and every 3 months for personals and for clothing. And one of the nicest things about Sojourner Truth House is that we recognize that while you could possibly get a food stamp card and be able to get food, you then cannot get personal items, personal hygiene items, feminine products, things for your children and things like that. So we have one of the largest food pantries in the area, but also one of the few that actually provide personal items.
Wow, wow. How many clients per month would you say that the house gets to serve?
We serve an average of 2,162 clients per month.
Wow.
So that's people that are coming in, that are walking in, some single persons and some with families, upwards of 6 or 8 or 10 people in the house.
So how many children would you say that probably covers as well?
Out of that, probably about half of them are children.
Wow, wow. Now, we ask about the Sojourner Truth House itself and what they do, because everything that is raised from the annual fundraising walk goes directly back into the operations of the house, and that's why it's very important to show your support for through the 19th annual walk for the Sojourner Truth House. If you will, Shrita, tell us where it's going to start on Saturday, June 9th, and where hopefully will end, and what people should do if they're interested in participating.
Okay. We will actually be taking the walk from the front of Sojourner Truth House, which is at 410 West 13th Avenue in downtown Gary, so that's at the corner of 13th and Madison, directly across from Frabel Park. Mm-hmm. The walk, the full route of the walk is 1.6 miles, and it basically goes around the park, out to Broadway, back down to 11th Avenue, and then back up and around Madison back to the ministry. There is also a shorter route for people who may want to take a shorter route or who may run the route. Some people will run several times, and that is around Frabel Park. So that's probably maybe the equivalent of about 6 city blocks.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good sized parking. So that's a pretty good sized walk to begin with there, even in its own right, I would imagine. So,
absolutely.
So getting started here on Saturday, June 9th, about, I guess, with the check-in about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the kickoff for the walk about an hour later. How many people tend to participate in the walk, certainly based on the years that you've been able to keep track of it?
In the years that I've been there, we have had anywhere from 300 to 500 participants. I want to also note that our honorary chair is the Honorable Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, and she's been a staunch supporter of Sojourner Truth House for a number of years.
Yeah.
And Bishop Don Hying is going to be our Grand Marshal, so he'll be with us again for the third year in a row this year.
That's great. That's great. Once again, this is the 19th annual walk. That is a fundraising event for the Sojourner Truth House in Gary. And again, it's going to start from in front of the house, which is around the corner of 13th and Madison, cross street from Frabel Park in Gary. If you're interested, that's going to be on June 9th, by the way. If you're interested, is there any place that people can get more information or they can get hold of you to ask about it?
They can register at walk4sth.org. Once again, that's walk4. Spelled out forsth.org, or they can call our special events coordinator at 947-8665. And registration, once again, is at 8 o'clock. The walk kicks off at 9 o'clock. You'll also have an opportunity to participate in some of the wellness events. We have a wellness tent there. There will be vendors there, and we'll be giving tours of the ministry so that people can see the different departments and see how their dollars will be spent.
Now, Shrita, I have to ask you before we finish up here, do any of the folks who take advantage of the house actually help participate in the walk?
Absolutely. From year to year, we will have actual clients who do everything from help with greeting people when they come in. They have been a part of our warm-up exercises in the past. You will see them at different stations. And one of the most wonderful things is the fact that as you see our clients look like everyone. So you won't necessarily notice, or they won't look like they should be receiving services. But that's the wonderful thing about Sojourner Truth House. We don't discriminate. People come to us where they are, and we want to get them where they want to be and to assimilate them into our interpretation of regular life.
Shrita Brewer, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this.
Thank you so much.
Shrita Brewer is with the Sojourner Truth House, located in Gary, and the house is going to have its 19th annual walk as a fundraising event coming up on Saturday morning, June 9th. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
There's some people out there that don't want the hope. They don't want it. And I've seen people who don't take the help. And then they end up in the same predicament that they were in. They don't have the same opportunities because they didn't take the opportunities that were given to them. But there are people out there that really need help. And there are people out there that don't want to be on the system forever, that don't want welfare, that don't take advantage of it. They're taking stepping stones to get where they need to get. And for that period of time, they have to let their pride go and get the help that they need. Housing Opportunities helps me by providing a roof. We go over goals. They help you find steps to finding a job. They give you resources to help you go to school. They introduce you to other nonprofit organizations that help you with other things. They helped my son with his speech therapy. They referred me to somebody. They referred me to First Steps. They referred me to Early Head Start. The Family Youth Service Bureau. They paid for my car insurance for the first 6 months when I first got my car. I graduated from them, I guess you can say now. But they were truly amazing, every single one of them that I had. Geminis Head Start, a nonprofit organization. My son went there for 2 years, and I loved the teachers that he had. One time I didn't have enough money to pay for my son's pictures. The teachers put in the money to buy his pictures. I mean, then you have food stamps and welfare that helps provide food, medical coverage. That helps a lot, too. My case manager, Cindy, is an incredible role model. She comes out to the apartment. She talks to us, goes over the goals. She's taught me how to be a mom. She's amazing. She is more than just a case manager to me. Right now, things are pretty good. I do watch children out of my house. Yes, it's not a lot of money, but I'm able to pay my bills. I'm able to buy my son what he needs, keep a roof over our head. I was looking for another job, and I'm going to start looking for another job again as soon as I have a reliable car. It's still hard. You still struggle, especially when your car is constantly breaking down. You don't have enough money to pay for everything and fix your car. So the bills have to come first and then the car. But I'm managing. We eat. We have a roof. He has clothes. I think people need to step outside of the box and look around for a minute and see that there are people out there that are really struggling and that are not taking advantage of the system and that really, really do need help. I think that it's just the way you look at it. If you've never been in that situation, then it's hard for people to understand what it's like. I think sometimes you have to step back and take yourself out of your situation and put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
You can find more original stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase. We're in the midst of a national reckoning of the barriers that prevent women from succeeding in the workplace. Part of that story is about sexual harassment, yes. But perhaps an equally large part is that women are often held to different standards. They have to work twice as hard, be twice as good, and more than twice as nice to get the recognition, salary, and authority that their male colleagues do. As it is in many fields, this is a problem in the STEM fields. In fact, it's so common that there's a name for it, the Marie Curie effect. One result is that women have a hard time getting ahead. Another consequence is that women who have often made vital contributions to our understanding of the world go unnoted and unrecognized. Today on Soundbites, we're going to hear the story of what happened when a Hoosier archaeologist working today excavated a glaring example of the Marie Curie effect in his own backyard. Meet Alan Kaiser, a professor of archaeology at University of Evansville, who started a rare kind of program for undergraduate archaeology majors in 2003. Alan's specialty as an archaeologist is using geographic information systems, which is a computerized technology that allows users to mark locations, measure distances between sites, and realize new insights about why things were the way they were. This is a different way to examine the past from the 3D models we spoke about in the last episode. GIS is not used to see an exact replica of something or to run scenarios to see what's possible. Instead, Allen uses GIS specifically to judge how visible historical buildings and sites were at the time they were in use. You might be thinking, why does that matter? Well, because in architecture, visibility has a high correlation with importance. If a temple on a hill were truly the tallest, most magnificent building that was visible from across a city, archaeologists would likely posit that it was very important. Using this technique, Allen noticed that classical archaeologists were sometimes wrongly assuming that a very visible historical site in the present was equally visible in the past. So Allen uses GIS to figure out the location and height of other buildings and structures that would have existed to gauge how visible, and therefore how important, a Roman temple was. He argues that GIS allows him to see that not all important sites on hills can be assumed to have been visible at the time of its use. Using GIS is a much faster and easier tool to do this work than anything that has been available so far. Allen's work with technology and archaeology is fascinating. However, he also uncovered information about a woman's life outside of the dig site that affected the world of archaeology just as much, if not more. It was the life and scholarship of a former professor at University of Evansville named Mary Ross Ellingson, who lived almost 100 years ago. Allen discovered her diaries and photo albums in his office at the University of Evansville, which laid out all the clues for him to piece together the story of how her Johns Hopkins advisor, mentor, friend, and big name in archaeology, David Robinson, plagiarized her work to boost his failing career. Let's start at the beginning of her story. In 1931, when at the age of 24, she sailed from New York to one of the most important archaeology digs of the 20th century, at Olynthos, Greece. At the time, she was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, and she was sailing to the site of one of her advisor, Robinson's dig in Greece. According to historical records, she was whip smart and one of three women to be selected to participate on the dig amongst more than 200 men. She was part of the second generation of female archaeologists, and it was a tough time to try to prove yourself as a woman. The well-known successes of a few brilliant women in the first half of the 20th century created an unreachable expectation for women. Today, scholars refer to it as the Marie Curie effect. If Marie Curie could win two Nobel Prizes, so too should every woman. In order to be allowed into the top circles of academia, women had to reach almost an impossible balance of raw intelligence, humility, grit, and politeness. It was unacceptable for women, even brilliant scientists and social scientists, to complain. It was a time of intense scrutiny of women, and for most women, it was too high a barrier for entry. Back to that dig in Greece in 1931. Mary worked full-time on the dig, just like everyone else. And on top of her regular work, she was also performing an independent project of documenting terracotta figurines. She kept a meticulous record of each artifact, including where it was found. Mary used new and innovative techniques in her recording of the pottery. Before then, archaeologists tended to only care about what they found in the ground. But Mary led a new generation that cared more about where items were found, which allowed Mary and those who came after her to have a better understanding of objects and how they were used in daily life. This work was for her thesis, and Robinson had no right to it. And yet, to boost his career, he published Mary's work as his own in a book about the digs at that site. He immediately gained fame and recognition among academics for his work at the Olympus site. Mary's work and possibly others that Robinson plagiarized made him the celebrated archaeologist he became. If not for sexism and prejudice, Mary herself would have earned admiration and leadership in archaeology. Instead, she used her passion for archaeology mostly as a hobby, but still did incredible things, like taking over the archaeology at the museum now known as the Evansville Museum of Arts, History, and Science, and increasing the public knowledge and understanding of indigenous tribes that lived in Evansville long before colonization. Back to Allen Kaiser, who teaches archaeology at the University of Evansville today. When Allen discovered Mary's story, he desperately wanted to share it, but he received lots of pushback from academic journals who were afraid to confront such an important figure in classical archaeology, David Robinson. However, Allen pushed on, arguing that uncovering the plagiarism of women is vital because women's footprint on our current knowledge of the world is largely unknown. His perseverance and insistence paid off. In 2014, Allen finally published his findings in a book called Archaeology, Sexism, and Scandal, on which this episode is based. Archaeology is, in some ways, the story of hidden truths. It takes patience and determination to uncover what time and circumstance have buried. Women's contributions to STEM, like those of Mary Ross Ellingson, are also hidden stories. It's through the humanities, history, and gender studies that we learn to look for the surface traces of where such stories may lie, undetected below the surface, waiting for people like Alan Kaiser to uncover them and share their glory with the world. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm Sondra Burton.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana lawmakers went back to the State House recently for a special session that was called to take action on a handful of bills that died back in March when the bickering Republicans brought the regular legislative session to a rather chaotic close. With us is one of Northwest Indiana's own delegation members. We have State Senator Eddie Melton from Maryville with us. Senator Melton, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's go through the list of bills. There weren't very many, I guess, that were taken up by the special session. That was at behest of the legislative leaders, or Republicans, in both the House and the Senate. So if you will bring us up to date on these five measures, and we can go into particular into House Bill 1315 in more detail, because that's in particular one that you're very concerned about. So if you want to just give us the list of the ones that made it through that are not quite as controversial in many respects to that one.
Right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share this with the listening audience. Like you mentioned, we have several bills that we came back to address that were not completed at the end of our regular session. We had House Bill 1230, which was to address school safety. We have House Bill 1242, which is state and local administration, some aspects, also a bill that dealt with technical corrections. 1315, as you mentioned, and we also had taxes and higher education bonding went through HB 1316. So those pieces of legislation all passed throughout the legislature. So I believe they've already gone to the governor's desk to be signed.
Let's see. The tax bills measure is, I guess you mentioned, is sort of one of them is sort of a correction, I guess, to get caught up as far as state statutes concerned to what the federal government is doing. And there's some other provisions as well, too. Tell us first about that.
Well, of course, everyone's familiar with some of the federal changes that took place in Congress and with the existing administration. So I think there were several things that we as a state had to do to kind of align with what took place on the federal side of things. So that bill addressed that. And like you mentioned earlier, there was a technical corrections bill that addressed several issues during the regular session that we had to come back and address in the special session.
I understand that I guess one of the things that we mentioned here before is that there was a special session called, I guess, to try to deal with what had happened at the end of the regular session. And I guess some of the discussion that came up, and you probably had a chance to talk among your colleagues about this, was that it was some of the provisions that were input in some of the bills that apparently came up in the last minutes or the last hours of the 10-week regular session that hadn't been properly vetted. Did that seem to be the case when you finally got the measures in front of you during the special session?
Yeah, there were some instances where members of our caucus at the end of the regular special session received a conference committee report where there were new things that weren't discussed and shared in regular committee meetings and with the authors. So there was some hesitation on our part to sign things that we weren't formally introduced to or made aware of and to sign them at the last minute. So I think that's an unfair practice to allow to encourage or force a legislator to sign a piece of legislation that there's new developments and not having a chance to vet that properly with oneself and especially with one's caucus.
Mm-hmm. Getting on to the major one, at least as far as we here in Northwest Indiana are concerned, out of the bills that came up before the special session, was House Bill 1315. And I know that you spent some time on the floor of the Senate talking about this and your concerns, as well as those of the rest of the Northwest Indiana delegation, about the impact that this measure is going to have on the Gary Community School Corporation. And we also know, too, of course, you had a big hand in the measure which passed last year that led to the official ability for an outside organization to take over the operation of the Gary Community School Corporation. But what were yours and your colleagues' concerns here about House Bill 1315, in particular, what it's going to leave behind for the students as well as parents and the leaders in the Gary community?
Right. Well, I want to make sure that I give a clear distinction for your listening audience that may not be aware of last year's measure.
Please, thank you.
Of course, the Gary School Corporation was over $100 million of debt. And a lot of these policies that passed at the state level helped to contribute to that. And that's part of the conversation that I wanted to encourage legislators to have when it comes down to the proliferation of the charter schools that we have in Gary. Gary is ranked sixth in the nation with the per capita of charter schools. Nearly probably 50% at this point of our students or more are in there. So when you have this level of population loss, that's going to have a dramatic impact. And also when we look at the impact of the property tax cap that hit, it not only impacted the school corporations across the entire state, but also other governing entities. So they had to adjust and do the best they can. And we see many school corporations within Northwest Indiana and across the state as well that's going for referendums to address operations, going for referendums that's addressing capital campaigns and capital initiatives just to keep up the maintenance of some of these facilities. But House Bill 1315 was unique. And like I mentioned before, we addressed the fiscal aspects of the Gary schools and even the Muncie schools, because they're the second school corporation that has been identified as a distressed entity. But 1315 was a far overreaching piece of legislation that had nothing to do with the fiscal emergency, and a fiscal emergency with the Gary School Corporation, nor did it have anything to do to address any emergency when it comes to Muncie School Corporation. The elements of this piece of legislation included the elected body of the Gary School Board, which are over half of these members are new to office. They have been reduced to an advisory committee. Then you have the number of their meetings have been reduced from once a month to four times a year. And to me and many of my colleagues, we felt that this was disenfranchising of voters. Individuals stepped into the voting booth and voted for these individuals to represent them for this particular unit of government, and their voice is being silenced in that process. The other piece of the legislation that we feel is overreaching extremely, and it sets a very dangerous precedent, in that the Muncie School Corporations have been technically given over to Ball State University. Now, as I talk about this, not being from Muncie, not being from that community, I'm not against innovation and thinking of creative ways to improve education. I just disagree with the way the legislature went about this process in terms of a very top-down approach where the legislature is telling the community that this is going to happen and not requesting input. Not going to the community and engaging them in this process, and not engaging parents, not engaging a lot of stakeholders. It was an afterthought. And I think this sets a very dangerous precedent in terms of how the certain legislators view how we should address urgent academic as well as fiscal issues. So those are two very important aspects that we have to be very mindful of moving forward in the future. Then, of course, you had collective bargaining that was jeopardized for a lot of teachers, giving administrators of these type of school corporations carte blanche to just riff or do a reduction in force before you even have a final headcount of students. not knowing if you're going to need those teachers, not knowing if you're going to need to add additional teachers, but giving them the flexibility to just make that call without having the full information. And lastly, I'll share this, the financial indicators piece. There was a piece of legislation that I was able to pass in 2017 that was a resolution to do a study where the Legislative Services Agency did an analysis and created a dashboard. From one of the things that I learned about going through this process with Gary and Muncy is how do we identify indicators that many of these school corporations show, such as a reduction in population, such as a change in local tax collection, and et cetera, and be more preventative in measures of providing technical assistance to these school corporations. My bill that I originally authored for this year, a lot of language was incorporated in this that made it helpful for districts, but it wasn't that way in the beginning. The original version was very punitive. It would have held school corporations and school boards and superintendents extremely to a point of not being able to provide a clear level of engagement with the state on this process, and it was more of a dangerous road we were traveling. But I'm happy that we were able to divert that aspect of the bill to a more sensible one, where we are able to work and collaborate with local school corporations.
I also understand, too, in a similar measure involving the economics, and here in Gary in particular, I know that you had also proposed, although not during the session, but earlier, this a very special Senate resolution that is in turn asking for a summer study committee to take a look at the economic development potential in the Buffington Harbor area of Gary. Do you think that not only is going to benefit, of course, the city of Gary, but that might in turn as well offer some help to the Gary Community School Corporation?
Well, I look at it as the entire region, if not the state, because we all know that there's a tremendous amount of underutilized assets that we have in Gary, and there's so many great opportunities in terms of economic development that I think we're heading down the right path if we collectively, as a region and as a city, figure out how we best partner with the state in terms of maximizing these opportunities, such as the future of double tracking, such as the growth and development around the footprint of the airport, intermodal logistics, potential development with the port, having a port authority that the mayor recently authorized. So I'm excited to see there are legislators willing to partner and collaborate to figure out how does the city of Gary potentially gain to benefit from increasing its potential and leveraging this existing assets. But it's a win-win for the region. It's a win for the state as well.
That's great. We have about a minute left here, Senator Melton. Let's take a peek, if we can, if you have any ideas or anybody suggested anything that you'd bring up as a possible piece of legislation that might be introduced in the next session coming up here in January.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm currently working with several stakeholders within my district, and my district represents Gary, Maryville, Hobart, Crown Point, Lake Station, and New Chicago, to have a very robust discussion around poverty. I believe a lot of my colleagues in the General Assembly on the other side of the aisle definitely celebrate Indiana being a very business-friendly state, and I think that's good as well. However, I think we need to focus more on the everyday individuals that are struggling, the working poor, the individuals that are disabled, veterans, our senior citizens, as well as our children and families that are struggling daily and struggling to make ends meet, and they're still working full-time jobs. We have to close the gap on housing. We have to close the gap on adequate housing, shall I say. Transportation is a big issue in our region, and figuring out how to connect communities across the board to get to assets and resources so folks can have a better shot at life, but also healthcare. And so the list goes on, but I'm hoping that we'll have the community engaged in these discussions, because I encourage folks to participate, reaching out to legislators to share your thoughts on how we can address these issues, because we're here to serve the community.
Well, Senator Belton, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Talking with Indiana State Senator Eddie Melton, who's a representative of the Northwest Indiana Legislative Delegation. This is Regionally Speaking. The 102nd running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race is coming up this weekend in Speedway, actually. I shouldn't say Indianapolis. That's such a bad habit to have, isn't it, though? It's called the Indianapolis 500, but Speedway is the actual community where, of course, the race happens at the Great Oval racetrack there in Speedway. And with this 102nd running coming up here, a lot of events happening between now and the time of the race itself on Sunday. Let's check in with Donald Davidson. He is, of course, the famous historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and it's nice to have you back on Regionally Speaking, Donald. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's take a look first here at some of the big events that have happened in days past here. We, of course, finally have a pole sitter, a fellow named Ed Carpenter, who I understand is a hometown hero. Tell us a little bit about Ed and about how he managed to make it onto the 2.5-mile oval and, in turn, be able to capture the pole for this year's running.
Well, Ed is the stepson of Tony George, but he was born in Paris, Illinois, but he's lived most of his life in the area, in fact, specifically Speedway for much of the time. He doesn't live there now, but he has actually at times in his life lived in Speedway, and we haven't had very many of those recently, but he's the real deal. He came up through quarter midgets and drove sprint cars. In fact, won the famous Pat O'Connor Joe James Memorial at the Salem Speedway, and that's a half-mile bank track that intimidates a lot of people, but Ed's got quite a record here. He's been in the 500 14 times, which is hard for me to believe. To me, he's the new kid that just came along. But this is actually his third pole, so he's in a very exclusive group, and he's extremely popular, not only because of the fact that he does a lot of charitable work and he's from the area, but he went to Butler, took courses at Butler, and so he's a Butler Bulldog. And so there's a huge cheer every time he goes out. And if he wins the pole for the Indianapolis 500, that's big.
Yeah, that's true. And he did so by getting past Team Penske, which is another another formidable group right there, of course, historic as well, too.
Yeah, they're running four cars. In fact, it was looking like they might start 1, 2, 3, 4, and that's never been done before. Mm-hmm. In fact, in 1988, 30 years ago, Rick Mears, Danny Sullivan, and Al Unser was the front row for Penske, and that's the only time ever that one team has occupied the entire front row for the start. It looked like it was might happen again, and then Ed Carpenter came along and spoiled the party.
Now, what did he finally clock as a time that got him into the pole this year?
I'm going to cheat and look that up. I have it right here. Yep. The four-lap speed was 229.618 miles per hour for the four-lap run. Mm-hmm. His opening lap was 230 and some change, and he had the only official 230-mile-an-hour lap this year.
What's been your assessment of the cars that have made it into the field of 33 for the race this year, as compared to some of the other recent races? Have they all been pretty much about the same? What seems to distinguish them from another? Obviously, they got Ed Carpenter over Team Penske and all the people behind him now to make it into the first row.
Well, it's a very tight group, and in terms of the elapsed time to do the four laps, 10 miles. There's 3.7 seconds, I'm looking down here, mm-hmm. between, so if you can imagine driving for 10 miles, and here comes the first one, and then the 33rd one is like 7/10 of a second behind that.
Yeah.
So it's a little more than that. It's like 3.7 seconds.
Yeah.
So, but per lap, I mean, it's just the blink of an eye.
Well, it sounds like it's more like a sneeze, I guess. You can only barely sneeze.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah,
it's just amazing.
It's really tight, and then also the difference this year was that they had more car driver combinations than there were starting positions, which has been 33 for many, many years, for reasons that I could explain, but we don't really need to go into that right now. Yeah. But it's for the fastest 33 qualifiers, and then there are two that did not qualify, and that's been a little while since that happened.
Now, in the event if something does happen and we happen to lose a couple cars, will they be able to bring those two that got bumped out to be able to bring him into the race now?
That's a good question. The rules that I understand, if there was to be one of them would encounter major difficulties in the carburetion, or the so-called carburetion runs. Nobody yeah. uses a carburetor anymore, but that's what they call it. On Friday, the team that has the accident, if their driver was injured, heaven forbid, or their car was destroyed, they do have the option to put another car of the same type in and maybe even switch drivers. So, famously, Pippa Mann did not qualify fast enough, and then James Hinchcliffe, who one would expect to be up at the front, through a series of really unfortunate circumstances, did not get to qualify. Or he actually did qualify, but not fast enough, and then ended up being left at the gate when the qualifications ended. It's looking like it's highly unlikely that that Hinchcliffe would be in the field on race day.
Oh, you talk about Pippa Mann kind of getting bumped out here. What's the latest this year for Danica Patrick?
Oh, she did very well indeed. She is actually starting on the inside of the third row.
Wow.
And so she had a really stout qualifying run, first time here since 2011. And that's created quite a bit of interest because she had all kinds of attention when she ran for the first time in 2005 was her rookie year, and she started fourth and finished fourth and actually led some laps and is the only female ever to lead. But she had a better record than I think than many people believe. She sort of kind of flew under the radar in the later years, mm-hmm. and she hasn't been here since 2011, but she had seven starts, and she made the top 10 in six of those. So her average finishing position is something like 8.7 or something, and it's very rare for a driver to have a single-digit average if they've had three or more starts. And she finished third in 2009, and it's funny, almost nobody seems to remember that one.
Uh-huh.
So she's been away for a while running NASCAR and had, as I say, a really stout run. And so I wouldn't count her out to have a really good finish on Sunday.
Well, that's very good. That's very good. Are there any special events coming up here ahead of the weekend, or certainly going into the weekend before Sunday's race we should know to?
Well, there's carburation runs on Friday, which is just a practice session for the
right.
cars that have qualified. But that gets a huge crowd. And there's a rock concert that goes on. There's the drivers' meeting on Saturday. And then following that, there is a display of vintage cars. The famous front-engine roadsters are being featured this year. But there's three groups of vintage cars that will go out. They've been doing this before the drivers' meeting. They changed the schedule this time.
Mm-hmm.
The drivers' meeting is from 10:30 until 11, and then the drivers are immediately put on buses and taken downtown for the 500 Festival Parade, which is a huge attraction.
Oh, yeah.
And then a lot of stuff still going on at the racetrack. So plus the short track events around the area, so it's really that there's no shortage of things to do. And then Friday night, there's dirt track racing out at the Indiana State Fairgrounds, so plenty to keep people busy.
Well, let me ask you, it's always a challenge for people who live up here in Northwest Indiana to make the trek down to Indianapolis, especially if they want to come down for the Indianapolis 500-mile race. What kind of things, with your vast experience in dealing with the travel and the crowds and everything around the Motor Speedway going into race day, what kind of things should the average person who maybe doesn't come down often enough to know these things, what should they know when they leave Northwest Indiana and head for the track in Indianapolis?
Boy, you know what? I don't know that I can really address that because I live in the area, so I don't have to contend with those.
I was going to say, you don't have to worry about that.
I don't have to worry about that. There's a dear gentleman, legendary, drove in the 500 and finished third in 60, and a major stock car driver and motorcycle racer before that. Paul Goldsmith lives up in your area. He lives in Griffith and runs the airport up there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what his route to get down here. In fact, I think he comes for a few days. And then I think he leaves on Saturday, and goes in the opposite direction. But I've had other people say, "Look, I'm staying with friends in Lafayette. What's the best way to get to the track on race morning?" And a lot of roads where you would normally be able to go are restricted, and so. I don't know that I could really answer that. It's better to be in the area, but whatever you do, come early for a variety of reasons, not the least of which that there's the pre-race activities. I'll just take a moment here. When people that are coming for the first time and they see the start time of the race and think, okay, well, I'll get into my seat 10 minutes before the start.
No.
I think you need to be several hours because there's all kinds of on-track activity with vintage cars and a parade of former winners, and there's just a lot goes on.
It's really, really fun to show up early and be able to sit there in your seat there in the grandstand or wherever it may happen to be there by the track and get to see all this happening before they bring it. And I understand, too, that Governor Holcomb is bringing in the green flag, so he's going to be coming in sometime. They'll probably airlift him in by helicopter, I'm sure.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I know that he comes, but no, I didn't know that.
That was something I had to say. The Associated Press had that on the wire this morning about that, so I thought, wow, okay.
I think he's
still overseas, but he'll be back from his latest trade mission in time
to come in for the race. I think he was going to like six countries or something, I think.
But he'll be back in Indianapolis in plenty of time for the race on Sunday.
I would recommend anybody coming. I think you ought to try and be in your seats by, I would say, 8:30 is a reasonable goal.
Well, it's not a bad piece of advice, to be sure. Donald Davidson is the historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He has been keeping track of the stats at the Speedway since before the beginning, I think. Well, no, not quite.
No!
A very long time. And we are really, really appreciative to have a chance to talk with Donald here. And thank you very much for the advice. And we hope that this year's race, 102nd running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, goes well. And maybe we'll see if Ed Carpenter can hang on to that lead there at the pole position and make it through the race and come out the winner. We'll just have to wait and see.
That would be huge.
That would be very interesting to see.
Yeah.
Donald, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow. We'll bring you a conversation with the Steve and Georgianne Panger.